It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer from Bleacher Report. Before I get to my esteemed guest, a quick reminder, this podcast is ending soon. I'm sad to say, at least on this feed, this podcast will be going away. The last episode of the Full 48 will publish the day after the championship is decided, which could be as soon as a few days from now. We're recording on a Monday. I'll be back with a new podcast, new platform, new name, sometime later this year, and hope you will subscribe to that as well. If you want to find out where I'm going, and I'd like to find out where I'm going, but if you want to know where the new podcast is and how to subscribe, follow me on Twitter, at Howard Beck. I'm going to find another way to get that word out soon, I hope, but I don't have it yet. But in the meantime, follow me on Twitter, at Howard Beck, and I promise I'll have more podcast news there. With that out of the way, very happy to welcome back to the podcast the governor of the LA Lakers, head of the Buss Family Trust, live from not quite the bubble, bubble adjacent, Bubbleville, Jeannie Buss. How are you?
I like to say the mini bubble because bubble is a really fun word to say. So as many people can use the word bubble, I'm down for that.
Absolutely. So you are not. So let's be clear here. So you are in the whatever the greater Orlando Disney area. You are not part of tier one, but you're in tier two. So you're behind the plexiglass. Like we've seen all the shots of you, Pat Riley, others, masks, everything else. But you still have to go through some kind of regimen, right? Like you're not, you can't just come and go freely like the average person.
Right. We're sequestered in our hotel. We have access to walk around the hotel, you know, sit outside, do things like that. But we're tested every day. And, you know, I've run into, you know, Pat Riley and Chris Riley and Mickey Aronson many times in this hotel. We're basically the only people here. So then when we go to a game, we're even separated from each other in our own suites that I have to stay 6 feet apart from everybody. So it's a kind of a strange experience, but I've actually really enjoyed the basketball. You know, I think the production that the NBA has done has really made it feel, even the difference between game two, which was a Laker home game, to game three, which was a Heat home game, felt completely different because they really incorporate all your game presentation. And so I really felt like I was at an away arena last night, even though I was sitting in the same arena as Tuesday night.
I guess we'll say that accounts for the loss. It was a tough road loss.
Yeah, that Miami's tough at home.
They're tough. But it's funny you say that, Jeannie. And yes, credit to the NBA because they've done as much as they possibly can, but as much as they can is still, you know, not much. And from home, I don't know how you felt when you were watching the last, you know, couple months at home before going to out there. But it at home from my own couch, it just looks like the same thing over and over, right? It looks like the same environment, same arena, same floor. And so it does still feel strange, but I mean, the atmosphere for you, you're obviously, you were not in Miami, you're closer. Did it feel, how do you describe how it feels to watch that versus your many, many years of games at Staples and the Forum before that?
Oh, I mean, it's, you can't, not having the fans there, you know, I mean, it's impossible to replicate, you know, fan responses. And that, you know, when a great play is made and, you know, when there's a player subbing in, you know, that's a fan favorite, you know, things like that. It's just odd. It just feels odd. But then, you know, for people who have been around basketball their whole lives, we've all been to high school games and, you know, little kids games. And, you know, so the game is the game, you know, what goes on the court is still there, but certainly, especially at Staples Center, we've created what I think is really a strong home court advantage because our fans are so passionate and knowledgeable about the game and they care so much that, you know, there's absolutely no way to replicate it. So we miss them.
Yeah. Are you finding yourself self-conscious about, I don't know, cheering, applauding, yelping, screaming at refs, and because like I assume everything travels really easily there. And I don't know how many other Laker officials you have in your contingent. Can you give me a sense of who else is sitting around you? How are you comporting yourself to try not to step over whatever bounds the NBA has set?
Well, you know, first of all, I've never yelled at refs, so it
I'm sure.
Matter bubble or no bubble. But you know, you know, when there's a good play, I find myself maybe getting a little too expressive, like I'm in a library, and it's kind of like, wait a minute, I should, you know, be a little bit more relaxed, a little more calm. But you know, and plus wearing a mask, I think that really kind of changes, you know, how you are as a person in terms of screaming or talking. It just, that kind of just lends itself to being muzzled. And so, you know, I think it's, you've got the crowd noise, you got the music, you got the game production and all of that. So it's like almost kind of like watching a movie. You'd kind of cheer when the good guy wins, you know, or the bad guy, you know, does something mean, like, but, you know, you're in a movie theater. It's like, wait a minute, I'm reacting to something, and, you know, everybody has their own reaction to their team. I would much rather be in the middle of, you know, 18,000 people at Staples Center than being isolated behind a mask, behind plexiglass.
Yeah. You know, I've started thinking ahead a little bit because especially when you guys went up 2-0, and not to get ahead of ourselves, but the series could go either way. All of that's a given. So I'm not going to assume an outcome. However, the championship is going to be decided sometime soon-ish. At that point, whether it's you and others in your contingent or the Heat contingent, everybody's going to have been tested in this secondary bubble. Are they going to allow like a real championship ceremony where, like, if you guys were to win, would you be able to be down there with Frank Vogel, Rob Pelinka, LeBron, AD, because you'll have been through a testing regimen? Do you know what the NBA has provided in that scenario?
When you're in the NBA finals, I mean, first of all, I haven't even thought that far in advance, but when you're in the NBA finals and you're under regular circumstances, the NBA controls what goes on the court. So I imagine if we find ourselves so fortunate as to be in that position, I will be told where to go and I will follow directions. So that's really more a question for the NBA, but you know, knowing how well and the NBA orchestrates and puts things together, I'm sure it will be something that is good for everybody.
Everybody in your position has a different way of kind of reacting to the ups and downs of a series and of the game, whatever. But this is your first finals as the governor for your franchise. And so I imagine that takes on a little bit more weight and import for you. And the loss last night was a rough game for your team. How were you just emotionally in that? How do you find yourself reacting? And is it heightened right now? Not just because of the finals, but in some ways, you've been through a lot of championships, but this one does take on maybe a different context for you.
Well, Howard, I hate to remind everybody, but we haven't been in the playoffs in 7 years. So I had to remind myself what it was like to be in the playoffs and the ups and downs of that. I think for me, the biggest difference is this is the first finals I, you know, can remember, you know, that Phil wasn't the coach. And so, you know, having him to talk to about, you know, his feeling about where we were headed and how things were going or who he was disappointed in or how, you know, what they were going to have to adjust to, you know, I really don't have that person, although I did text him this morning and said, ask him if he saw the game. I haven't heard back yet. But, you know, as the governor of the team, and given the circumstances of COVID and being in the middle of a pandemic and also the outside, what in the outside world with social injustice issues, I am so proud of all the teams and all the players and the staff who have committed to be here and to help us complete a season that started by virtue of calendar a year ago.
It's crazy.
And it is, it's crazy to think about. A year ago this week, we were getting on a plane to go to China to play in a preseason game. And here we are a year later under these circumstances, and so much in between has happened. So I think for me, this will be definitely one for the history books, many, many great chapters of Laker history, but this is something that, you know, nobody can compare anything to. And I think the human resiliency of our players and staff really is something I'm more proud of than the wins and losses. And the idea that we've seen many of the top seeds go down in this tournament, we worked very hard to be at the top of the Western Conference at that beginning of March. And we've stayed, you know, we finished, we won the Western Conference. And that's really, you know, with what you earn by having the top record is a home court advantage. And that was completely washed away. So I am just, you know, humbled at what has been accomplished thus far. And I hope that we can continue on this path and on this journey. But, you know, we have a ways to go before it's done.
A little ways to go, for sure. But two wins away still. And so it's just, I mean, I feel like it's just close enough that, you know, when you're up 2-0, I think it's probably natural to think ahead a little bit. You've been around long enough to know not to do that. I'm sure Phil would be the first to caution you not to. But I think of it this way, too. 2 years. So the last time you were on this podcast 2.5 years ago, it was All-Star Weekend in L.A. And one of the things we talked about was the fact that there were no Lakers in the All-Star game. And here we are 2 years later, we're talking again and you're in the finals. You have two of the biggest stars in the game, one of whom is one of the greatest stars of all time. Rob Pelinka, who was your hire, and one, you know, that certainly came with a lot of questions from the outside, including from me. Frank Vogel, these are your people that are in place now. Not to mention, we don't need to get into all the past, you know, just the legal battle for control of the team with your brother and everything else. Like, you've been through a lot just to get to this point, and this team, this franchise really has your imprint on it right now, Jeannie. So that being the case, the figurative ownership in addition to the literal, do you feel more of an ownership of what your team has accomplished and what it may yet accomplish in the next, you know, 5 to 10 days?
Well, certainly that's our hope. For me, it's, you know, the idea from not being in the playoffs to now being in the NBA finals is really remarkable. But when Magic Johnson joined us as the head of basketball operations, and, you know, together, you know, the decision was made to hire Rob Pelinka as the general manager, that, you know, I think some of the, you know, pushback or the questions, even from you, was about the transparency of the process and about, you know, usually when people go about hiring somebody, they interview several candidates and, you know, really do a, you know, take their time to hire the right person. In our case, what was happening, which is still, you know, it was a complicated legal issue that was going on between me and my brother. And it was important to me to make that change during the season prior to, it was in February of 2016 that we made the change because of, am I getting my year wrong? It's, anyway, it was, what was, if we had, you know, interviewed candidates for the job of general manager, that would have further tipped off my brother. And like I said, we were in a legal battle and things had to be done so swiftly so that the franchise could be stabilized. And that's the importance of Magic Johnson to be at the helm of the ship while I dealt with the legal battle that was in front of me. And it was important that our fans knew that Magic Johnson stands for nothing less than Laker greatness, and that he would not tolerate doing anything that wouldn't be best for the franchise. And that's why he was so important at that crucial time in what was going on in the boardroom, which really shouldn't worry the fans. They have enough to worry about. They don't need to know the infighting that was going on. But it was a serious threat to the franchise and could have put us into, you know, complete chaos. So while I was dealing with that, Magic and Rob were, you know, taking over the basketball operations, because there was concern that prior to the trade deadline, that trades would be made that we wouldn't be able to recover from. And that's why the swift movement had to happen. And that's why we couldn't go through a process of interviewing. Whereas when the opportunity came to us the last offseason to hire a new coach for the Lakers, we went through that process and we interviewed, you know, Monty Williams, Juwan Howard, Ty Lue, and Frank Vogel. And we went through that transparency, that process of interviews, gathering information, finding out which candidates would be the right fit for us. And I think, you know, so you can see we're not, you know, decisions made at the Lakers weren't just like knee-jerk reactions. There was a specific reason why Rob, you know, was the right general manager for us. And certainly you can look that there seems to be maybe, if you look at people like Arne Tellem, former agent, now head of basketball for the Detroit Pistons. You look at Bob Myers, former agent, who's head of the Golden State Warriors. I don't think it was really out of, you know, didn't come from left field. It was something that, you know, Rob and I had a good relationship because he at that time was Kobe Bryant's representative, as well as many other players, former and current NBA players, as his clients.
All that said, do you feel now, you know, given where you are, is there a feeling of whether it's vindication or is it just fulfilling to see the decisions that you made, however much they might have, you know, seemed controversial at the time to some people? Does it feel, is there a sense of fulfillment and vindication at this moment where, you know, you're two wins away from a title, you are in the NBA finals, things have worked out. There's been some bumps, clearly, but things have worked out on the whole pretty well at the moment.
Well, none of the decisions ever were made about ego. Like it wasn't, I don't need vindicated or validated. Because if you look for validation from the media, you're never going to get it. That's not how you do it. The success comes from the work. And I knew surrounding myself with people who had integrity and would do the work and saw Lakers basketball as I saw Lakers basketball, then, you know, it just takes time to get things going in the right direction. And when Magic and Rob came in, we had kind of a messy, you know, salary cap that, you know, we had players under contract that didn't fit the other players we had on the roster. Like we just kind of had a mishmash, and that can't be, as we know, with the salary cap and the way the NBA works, you can't solve those problems overnight. But, you know, to be here this soon, it really was, I never thought they could do it as fast as they did. But certainly, you know, here we are. And that, you know, I guess that the proof is in that, in the actual success, not in a press release, not in a press conference where we, you know, stood up there and told everybody this is what we're going to do and then expect it to happen because we said it at the press conference 6 months earlier. You know, we knew we were going to take arrows and, you know, a lot of, you know, backlash and pushback and hate on social media. But that's, you know, that's not how you run a team. You don't run a team by responding to people on social media. You do the work, and the proof is in the work.
You mentioned Magic earlier and in needing to, you know, hire people who you knew had the integrity and the best interests of the Lakers at heart. And nobody would ever doubt Magic's intent on that level. He is as the ultimate Laker. But the irony of that is that some of the messier moments in the last couple of years were caused by Magic that he was at the center of, including his abrupt departure, which you have said even recently, you know, you're still not clear on exactly why it had to happen the way it did, but it did. How would you characterize, because you guys have known each other since you were 19. How would you characterize your relationship now, given the messiness of that separation from the team?
Well, he was 19 and I was 17 when we first met. He was our draft pick. And back then, and it, you know, for your younger listeners, back then you did not draft kids that young.
Yeah.
You know, people, there was really this belief that you wanted them to be in a college program, be 22, so that you kind of knew, you know, the person that you were getting. That was risky to draft somebody so young. So, you know, Magic and I, you know, 2 years apart, and he has been, you know, just, he's been a part of my life since that day. So we're talking, you know, 40 years of friendship. I got a wonderful message from him yesterday, and, you know, he's as excited about this Laker team, and we would not be here in the NBA Finals if it wasn't for him, because he brought the stability which led a free agent like LeBron James to feel confident in the organization that we were going in the right direction and that we were doing things for basketball reasons, that we were building a team to win because of Magic. And without him, you know, creating that path, we wouldn't be here. So he is, while he's not part of the day-to-day operations for us, he is somebody that is, I'm as close to today as I ever have been. And I just wish he would have, you know, been able to share with me, you know, his frustration and or anything that was bothering him. I think he's at peace with his decision. We're at peace with his decision. And, you know, he's doing the things that he loves to do. And, you know, there just isn't anybody better. And he's somebody that I will treasure forever. He's just a big part of my life.
So the friendship is clearly more than intact. It's just fine.
Yes. Yes.
And look, I mean, listen, whether it's in our families or our friendships, we all have these ups and downs, right? So we're going to disappoint each other now and then. And we, you know, people, you move through them. So I'm not surprised at that. But I did wonder just how difficult it was to kind of, you know, work through that. Because when the business part of it gets involved too, and it was messy, and there were things he said about Rob Pelinka, who you were still obviously working with. And it seemed for a moment there like that might, you know, I wasn't sure if the gears might get stuck a little bit. Or did, like, was there a point where did you need anything from Magic? Like, is that, do you guys know each other well enough that you don't need like a specific explanation or apology or anything? Do you just move on, or did he ever offer that along the way?
No, you know, it's funny because it reminded me back when he was a player in, I think it was 1981. And at that time, you know, for your younger listeners, the history lesson goes that my dad bought the team. He hired Jack McKinney as the head coach. Prior to that season, the 1979 season starting, Jack McKinney was involved in a bicycle accident and was severely injured. So Paul Westhead filled in as the head coach in that capacity. Now with, you know, now they were down one assistant coach. So what they did was they took the guy who was doing radio with Chick Hearn on the broadcast, because they thought, well, here's a guy whose schedule's cleared, you know, because he would be traveling with us anyway doing the broadcast. And it was some guy named Pat Riley became the assistant coach under Paul Westhead. So we won a championship that first year, 1980, Philadelphia. The following year, Paul Westhead had decided he wanted to change, you know, in order to, you know, preserve Magic's, you know, energy during a game. He wanted to change the offense that took the ball out of Magic's hands. And that didn't make Magic happy. And he, you know, was sharing his frustration with my father. And this was early in the season in 1981. And the team was scheduled to leave for Utah for a road trip. And my dad said to Magic, you know, I hear what you're saying. You know, go on this road trip. And then when you get back, let's talk about it. And during that trip in Utah, Magic, after the game that they lost, Magic went to the media and said, I want to be traded. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm not happy. And, you know, that led to another change, which led to Pat Riley becoming the head coach of the Lakers. So to me, that feeling that Magic shared back, you know, a year ago, April, was very similar to that event in Utah, where it just, he wears his heart on his sleeve. And if that's how he's feeling at the moment, that's what he's going to share. And so we were all disappointed in that the end of that season, which was LeBron's first season as a Laker. We were at one point were in the top four in the Western Conference. Then LeBron got hurt on Christmas Day. And then the season just started to unravel as more and more rumors, you know, before the trade deadline, who was going to be traded. And, you know, the young players on our squad had never dealt with things like that before. And things just kind of went in the tank. And I think we were all feeling that frustration. And it was the last game of the regular season. And I think you just saw a person who just, you know, as I said, he wears his emotions, you know, on his sleeve. He shared exactly how he was feeling, and he just didn't want to do it anymore. And I understood that. And I just wish, you know, I had been there to give him more support, you know, that day. But I had a flat tire. And I was late to the game, so I wasn't there yet. And so maybe he was mad because I was late. I don't know. But, you know, he was just frustrated, and understandably so, because it was very disappointing. And he doesn't like losing. Magic doesn't like to be part of losing. That's the worst thing, you know, a player like him ever went through was losing. So I understand his frustration. I wish I could have made it better for him. But like I said, he's at peace with his decision. I'm at peace of where we are. And, you know, it did not affect our friendship and our love for each other.
It's interesting hearing you recount the whole, you know, Paul Westhead to Pat Riley, everything. I mean, obviously you lived it all. Did your father include you in those conversations? Like when you're telling it, it's almost as if you lived it as he did. Were you involved in those, not involved in those discussions necessarily in a way where you were working on it, but did you literally like live these things through him? Was he bringing you into like, you'll never guess what happened today. I can't, you know, we have, you're nodding your head for people who obviously can't see on the podcast.
Yes.
So that's fascinating because your reference points then are not just things that your dad told you about after the fact or described. You literally did kind of live through these things.
Well, I mean, just in the perfect illustration of that was running into Pat Riley here in the lobby, you know, because LA's never played Miami in the finals. Like it's happening. We always wanted it during the Kobe LeBron era in LA, Miami, but it never happened. So now, you know, I haven't seen Pat in a long time. You know, we're all wearing masks downstairs, but his first words to me in front of, you know, a group of people is, I've known you since you were 19. Like that's how I've known you since you were 19, which is the truth. I mean, when I talk about him being the radio guy to Chick Hearn, he was Riles. Like we didn't, you know, and when he became the head coach of the Lakers, we weren't allowed to call him his old nickname. He was now coach. You had to address him as coach. So, I mean, I've known him as he has, you know, gone on to be, you know, one of the greatest coaches, front office people ever in the history of the NBA. But, you know, when he sees me as a 19-year-old kid. So, yes, I was around all the time. You know, yes, my dad would share things with me, usually just to vent, you know, someone to listen to. I lived with him after I graduated from high school. So sometimes I'd be the only person around when he just wanted to, you know, talk about a game or, you know, just, you know, bounce things off somebody. So yeah, I have a unique lens to, you know, the last 40 years of Lakers basketball.
Can you call Pat now, or is he still coach?
I call him Pat.
That's good. That seems fair. When you're the governor of the Lakers, I think
weird because we're not allowed to hug. We're not allowed to. It's just COVID is like, it makes everything so awkward and different.
It's all maddening.
We all feel it. Yeah, we all feel it.
There have been any number of times over the last, whatever, I don't know, 10, 15 years. It hasn't happened that many times, maybe. But occasionally there's the, well, Phil Jackson's moving on. Maybe they make another run to bring Pat Riley back in the fold. Or then every so often it kind of bubbles to the surface, or a little bit of speculation, the idea of bringing him home. But I mean, he's been with Miami for, I don't know how many years it's been now, but, you know.
I think it's 25 years.
Has it ever been a serious discussion? Was there ever any attempt? Did you ever yourself think in the last, say, 10 years or during your time running the team that this would be a nice way to complete the circle, bring him back to where he started?
Well, there was actually a discussion of bringing him back. You know, of course, it was when my dad was, you know, still running the team with my brother, Jimmy. But after Phil left in 2004, you know, they asked permission because, you know, when a person, even an executive, not just a player, there's tampering with executives as well. They asked permission of the Miami Heat to talk to Pat Riley about coming back and coaching. And in that conversation, I believe what happened was Pat said, you know, if you guys are interested in me coming back, I would like to have a phone call with Kobe and a phone call with Shaq. And I think my dad at that time said, well, I think I'm, you know, going to be trading Shaq. And I think Pat went, what? And went right back to Miami and made a deal to get Shaq in Miami, which ended up leading them to a championship. So, you know, so yeah, I guess there had been discussions at some point for him to come back. Again, when I go back to, you know, when Magic came aboard and Rob Pelinka as general manager, I was in, you know, entrenched in a legal battle that was, you know, it was a risky time, and I could not afford anything to leak out. And so, you know, there wasn't any kind of attempt to ask permission to speak to people who were under contract to other teams at that time, because it could have led to, you know, a lot of bad repercussions on the legal front for us.
Yeah. So instead, you just have to beat him for the championship.
I have to hand it to them. That team is really they're really good. They're in the finals for a reason. They're well coached. They have great personnel. You know, finding some of the players they've found, you know, late in the draft through free agency and trades, they built a really nice team. And, you know, I admire them as always. As we know, Pat will always do things to be successful and to give his players the highest chance at success.
Jeannie, I know you know the game very well. But you have always made a distinction, and especially when, you know, when Phil was there, you said, you know what, Phil does the basketball, I'm president of the business side. Like, that's my domain. And you always drew a hard line there, but your role is different these last several years as governor of the team. And I saw, I think it might have been a Facebook post, but, you know, a photo of you Zooming with Frank Vogel. Are you more involved these days? Do you find yourself involved in more of those discussions? Do you... Not that you're necessarily going to tell, you know, Rob Pelinka, hey, trade this guy or draft this guy, but has your involvement on the basketball side grown in the years since you have taken control?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and Howard, you came to our training facility. And, you know, when I show people our training facility, so much of what I learned from Phil Jackson is incorporated into, you know, the lay the facility. So I can't help but have been influenced by, obviously, my father and, you know, his marketing, his style of Laker basketball, as well as Phil Jackson. And how he defines, you know, a player, you know, someone who does the work, who's willing to sacrifice for the greater good of the team, and obviously David Stern. Those are my, and of course Kobe Bryant and Magic. You know, these are the people who have influenced me, and I think that, you know, Laker basketball is about that exciting style of play and, you know, bringing together a group of players who are willing to accept their role on the team and contribute from that point of view. So while I'm not going to say we need another shooting guard or we need to play the pinch post or whatever, I don't get involved in that. But in terms of supporting the people that are there to do their job, that is important. And that is something I learned from my dad, get the best talent. I learned from Phil, you know, how to bring people together to collaborate and be a team through tribal leadership. And, you know, yes, all those pieces, you know, you put in and that's, you know, that's what I go to and that's what I believe. And that was what was frustrating for me when my brother and Mitch were running the Lakers. I couldn't understand what it was that they were building. It seemed everything kind of contradicted each other. It's impossible to go from a coach, a great coach in Mike Brown, who's very defensive minded, to another great coach, Mike D'Antoni, who's very offensive minded. A roster can't make those, you can't change a roster that quick when you're changing coaches every 18 months. That's what I couldn't understand. And, you know, bringing stability and culture is important. And, you know, that word culture is, I don't know if it's overused or is too vague to really understand, but it's really about, to me, culture is about the collaboration and the, you know, people, there's no barriers to people working together, that there isn't silos of power that can't cross over and actually work at cross purposes. Every person that works at the Laker organization is part of the team, from the players to the coaching staff to the employees at the office. And that Zoom call that you're referring to with Frank Vogel, that was with all of our employees. Yeah. That was for every person, you know, because since the shutdown, we have shut down our offices. So everybody's at a work at home mode. And, you know, having Frank, you know, come together and talk to the employees was really just about bringing us together to remind us of our common purpose.
I was curious about, you mentioned David Stern and you mentioned lessons learned from a couple others that we've talked about, people who are influential. Is there one thing that David told you that you've been carrying, you know, over the last few years, obviously, in particular, but in especially since losing him in January? What are David Stern's words that are resonating with you at a time like this?
Well, he always appreciated what he talked about when my dad passed away was how my dad, even if it was not, you know, best for his team in particular, my dad always cared about what was best for the league, and that he was a leader in that way. He didn't think about using his influence at the board to just favor the Lakers. He wanted the league to be strong. He wanted, you know, he was, you know, supportive of revenue sharing. He was supportive of things that, you know, again, may not have been best for the Lakers in terms of you know, what, you know, the Lakers could make more money if there wasn't revenue sharing. But he knew that it was important to have 30 healthy teams that could compete for a championship. And, you know, when he bought the team, there was no such thing as a salary cap. You know, a salary cap is what allows this league to have teams in smaller markets be able to compete and keep their teams together and their star players together. You know, and you know, that global thought about what, you know, keeping the league healthy is, you know, something that he appreciated. And that is something that I feel that I bring to the board as well.
It's funny, Jeannie. I think fans, especially fans in smaller markets who envy the Lakers or the New York teams or Miami or, places that are the glamour markets or larger markets, they would view that probably skeptically. Oh, why would the Lakers be looking out for it? They don't really do. It always reminds me of, I can't remember which year it was. We were in Honolulu for training camp, and your dad would meet with us with the beat writers during training camp. And we were up there in some hotel tower, and he talked about, this was right before the tax or about the time the tax was going to go in after it had been approved in the 98-99 CBA. And he said, your dad being the ultimate poker player, I can't remember if I told this story last time you were on the pod, but your dad said something to the effect of being, as a card player, as a poker player, he's like, the way we know who the best is, you know, you have your chips, I have my chips, we have the same amount of chips, and then let's see who's the best. And I'm botching his quote, but it was basically along those lines. The idea was that let's get the same number of chips and then we'll see who's the better player. And that was his way of supporting, rhetorically speaking, the luxury tax. He very much did. He supported the idea of making sure that no one market could use its financial might to overwhelm everybody else. Like, that was a real thing.
That's true. And you didn't tell me that story before. And that, you know, my dad was an excellent poker player, so I always appreciated his poking for analogies, because I'm a terrible poker player.
did not inherit the card playing skills. Huh?
I did not.
Did he teach you the game?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, he tried constantly to teach me, and he said, you know, he goes, what people don't understand, what makes a great poker player is the stamina. You have to wait for the cards. And most people, you know, they want to rush it. They want to bluff. They want to, you know, they do all this. He said, and he goes, I know you can do all that because I know you have patience. You have stamina. He goes, but when you get the cards, you have to be able to go from 0 to 100 in a heartbeat. He goes, that's where I don't know if you can do that. And I feel that, you know, the hardest thing for me in this business is to trade away players. And in order to get a player like Anthony Davis meant that we had to give up, you know, players that, you know, we drafted and that were, you know, near and dear to my heart. And so that quote came into my mind because it was kind of like, okay, that we have the cards, we have, you know, the pieces that we need, you know, we have great value in these pieces here to get, you know, the big, you know, to get Anthony Davis, but to get him, you have to give up something of great value. And that was very hard for me to do, but you know, we did it, and I believe it was for the right reason, and the players that we gave up, you know, I still cheer for them and want to see them do well. And, you know, but to have a player like Anthony Davis, it was about going from 0 to 100 in a heartbeat and not doubt your decision. And, you know, I think he would be very proud that Anthony Davis is a Laker.
No doubt. And LeBron, too, of course. So speaking of that, you know, you we've talked about this. Your dad famously considered, you know, Magic Johnson like a son. He considered Kobe like a son. And I know you're very close, you know, to Magic, and you were very close with Kobe. every team owner does this a little differently in terms of whether they want to know their players, how well they want to know them, how much of a distance they want to keep. What's the balance for you? And I'm thinking specifically about LeBron, who obviously is one of the greats of all time. He hasn't been a Laker for that long, but this season, because of all the unusual events of this season, and partially because of where you guys are right now, partially because of losing Kobe and the bond that they finally started to create just, you know, right before we lost Kobe, it feels like LeBron is more of a Laker today than he was a year ago. I keep thinking about a Plaschke column. I don't know if you know, so Bill Plaschke had written, it was when LeBron had passed Jordan on the scoring list, the all-time scoring list. And it was a little bit, by Staples Center standards, maybe a little bit of a tepid response. I don't think he was fully embraced yet. And I think the media there kind of noted that. And it's understandable. I mean, LeBron and Kobe were kind of, they were rivals for a while in a way. He had already won three championships before coming to you guys. He's coming later in his career. Like, I was always very curious how that dynamic would unfold. And it seems like he very much is embraced right now. And a lot of it, again, the unique events of the last, you know, year. I'm curious your impression of that, Jeannie, just how the bond between LeBron and the fans has grown, but also from your perspective, having seen how your dad was able to create a relationship that was way beyond just the business side with Magic, with Kobe. How would you describe the dynamic between you and LeBron at this point?
Well, you know, we finally, you know, his first season, you know, of course I met him, you know, didn't really get to spend any time with them. And then finally, you know, we decided we should have dinner. And, you know, for the travel, the schedule, everything, that dinner didn't take place till that March. And it was, you know, I didn't know what to expect, just getting to know somebody. And he had, you know, he's such a, you know, student of the game, like the history of the game. He's so smart, and he's so well read and articulate, and he picks up things so quickly. He had done a deep dive into the Lakers history. So when we sit down to dinner, he starts telling me about the things that he learned that he didn't even know about, you know, what my dad built. And why he and who my dad was. And, you know, of course he knew who Jerry Buss was, but like he really took the time to learn about, you know, before he was born and, you know, the history and the kind of stuff he said to me really, you know, kind of took me aback that he really knew who my dad was and the history of the Lakers. And he just said that he said, you know, your dad really showed a lot of faith in you to put you in charge of what he built. And that really touched my heart because, you know, he's an outsider seeing, looking in, and for him to see that and to see that value really meant a lot to me. And, you know, from there, we've just, you know, our relationship has grown. And, you know, he's a busy person and I would not impose on his time. But I think the way he has represented the Lakers through the tragedy of losing Kobe Bryant and his daughter, Gianna, has, you know, his leadership has, you know, been so comforting for Laker Nation. And, you know, I just am grateful that he's here and that he's a Laker and that he's enjoying himself and that he's led this team to the NBA Finals. So my relationship obviously is different with him than it was with Magic, than it was with Kobe, you know, with, you know, so many players, but he's somebody who has shown me what a compassionate, empathetic, smart, and fearless leader he is. And he's inspired me at, you know, I've been in this business for 40 years and some days it's hard to keep going and, you know, to not get down. But he, as he's said many times publicly, he has, you know, strong shoulders and he can carry he can carry those who need it sometimes. And he's been that strength for me. And when he, I forget which, if it was the Houston series or during the Denver series, in his post-game comments, he brought up my dad's name. And I was so touched by that because he obviously never played for Dr. Buss. But the fact that he holds that in his heart about my dad, you know, really, really touched me and meant a lot.
He has a great humanity about him. He really does. Mm-hmm. And that's real. And I think people maybe sometimes aren't sure what to think when he's speaking out on issues or investing, you know, in a school in Akron and everything. But like this stuff is real. Like, he does. He has a great humanity about him. It's occurred to me a couple of times, Jeannie, that your legacies are kind of intertwined now a little bit. You know, LeBron's is secure in the sense that he's, you know, he got his three rings before he ever got to L.A. He could have retired after the Cleveland one and he'd go down as one of the all time greats. And people can argue about him versus Michael till, you know, for the rest of time, or him versus Michael versus Kareem, depending on which generation is in this debate. But this, you know, to win a championship or maybe more in a Laker uniform cements him in a different way. Both broadly within the NBA, but also specifically with your fans and with LA. And while you were there for the 10, I think, championships under your father, again, back to what I opened with, that this would be one that is on your watch. You and LeBron are kind of tied together right now.
Yeah, and I you know, I can't think of a better person to be tied to and to have him represent what my father built and being part of the purple and gold. I mean, certainly he's got, you know, ties to the Miami Heat, to the Cleveland Cavaliers, but certainly his page in Laker history is going to be special as well.
Yeah. And still being written.
Yes.
I didn't want to get, too deep on this one, but I would feel remiss if I didn't bring it up. And you lost your mom last December as well. My condolences again on that. Joanne Buss is not a name that I think, you know, people were too familiar with for obvious reasons. Your father was the one running the team. And so for NBA fans, Laker fans, that's who they relate to or the name they knew. But you wrote a touching tribute to your mom on Facebook back in January. What is the lesson from Joanne Buss that you're still carrying with you, or what trait of hers do you feel like you are still, you know, or is most prominent as you're running things?
I think every person who had the pleasure of meeting my mom would talk about how sweet she was. And so I think I have that. That's more my nature than the card shark that my dad was. So I have that, you know, that sweetness that, you know, it comes from, you know, love in my heart. And, you know, my mom, you know, she was just a lovely, lovely person. And, you know, we were sad to lose her. But, you know, it was tough because I literally went from losing my mom to losing David Stern to losing Kobe in about a 30-day span. And that was, really, you know, those were tough moments. And I still feel, you know, the weight of that, and that may never change. We all go through loss in our lives, and we hold on to the things that, you know, were special about that person and what they meant to us. And I think that, you know, with the loss of Kobe and Gianna, Laker Nation really, I think what Laker Nation, the best fans in the NBA are Laker fans, whether they're in Los Angeles or scattered throughout the globe, there's a strength in each other. And because of Laker Nation, the memory of the people that we love and cherish, like Chick Hearn, like my dad, like Kobe, we keep that together, and we hold that together, and we comfort each other, and we won't let that go, and we will carry that, and that gives me peace of mind.
That's beautiful. No, that's really well said. It's funny. Chick, I always think about Chick because my early years covering your team, he was so supportive, but I'll never forget him chastising me for missing a preseason game. A preseason game because it was on my wife's birthday.
But it did the fact that he noticed. You know what I mean? Like he
noticed.
He was as sharp as any but he, like that's those are the kind of things he watched everything. And what I miss about Chick is he was so great at helping our fans accept things. Like, you know, he just, you know, he would chastise the front office if there was a trade he didn't like, but then he would, you know, he would get kind of let it vent and then he'd bring us back around. Like he was, you know, and I feel, you know, the generation that doesn't know the pleasure of Chick Hearn, you know, they're he's irreplaceable. There'll never be another one. He's great.
One in a million. The other one that one other story that just comes to mind because you were saying, because this was it. He was the conscience of the team in a way, and he was also like the ultimate fan. But on the microphone, the night that you guys honored him for, I think, setting the record for most consecutive games, the last thing he said on the microphone before going back up to his perch was, you know, and come on, Lakers, get it together. You're playing like dog crap or something. I'm going to go get you some Alpo.
I don't remember that, but
I don't know.
Yeah, be Chick.
strange things that stick in my head, Jeannie. I don't know, like of the memories to pop up. Why that one? I don't know. But it did. And I wanted to touch on this before I let you go. You mentioned earlier, alluded to just all the various circumstances that the restart, the NBA restart, started under, including social justice. Every sports team, every corporation, everybody, period, has handled this differently. You guys were very proactive. I felt like very quickly after George Floyd, after his death, that the Lakers were among all the teams in LA got together to form a sports alliance for social justice. You guys hired, I hope I pronounced her name correctly, Dr. Karida Brown?
Yes.
Okay.
UCLA.
Yeah, from UCLA as Director of Racial Equity and Action, which was a new position for you guys. You guys have been very assertive and definitive about where you stand on these issues. But that can come with a cost. There is risk. There is backlash sometimes. You shared with the public a nasty note that you got at one point. Tell me about just your decision as the governor of this team to decide to make that stand regardless of what backlash it may have caused or what fans it might have potentially turned off. And then I'm curious just about, too, and this is obviously kind of sewn into this, what is the responsibility of a team at a time like this, especially in a league that, as you've noted or your team has noted in that statement, is 80% Black?
Well, you know, first of all, when I shared that letter on social media, I shared it because my white friends don't understand what the hate that's out there, that racism does exist. And so I was trying to share it with them that this is what happens. It's not that white privilege is that you don't have to, and what could happen to you if you're pulled over by the authorities. So, you know, things can't change until, you know, my white friends realize that this is truly a problem. And we brought in Dr. Karida Brown from UCLA to help educate all of our employees about how we got to where we hard to explain why this is continually happening over and over again, and saying, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with the victims. It's time for action, time for change. And this is all something that my dad always believed in, that, the treatment of people, all people are equal. You know, that was something he was passionate about. So we are just trying to be more assertive in our message and, you know, a partner with groups that, you know, such as More Than a Vote, to make sure that there is no voter suppression, that everybody has access to voting, that people are registered to vote, because every voice matters. This is a democracy. And, you know, just being more proactive. And yes, it comes with a backlash when I get a nasty letter like that. I recently got a letter from somebody who said that they would no longer be a Laker fan because of our stance. And, you know, and it wasn't a hateful letter. It had no swearing or anything. It just said, I'm tired of this, or I don't want to hear this. And I wrote this person back and I said, you know, I accept your decision, you know, because that's your decision. But what I won't accept is I'm never going to shut the door on our relationship. If you've been a Laker fan through history, you are part of our history, and that door is never going to close. And we're in very divided times in this country, and I don't want to further divide it. I think that people need to educate and try to understand what the issues are and why these things are happening over and over again. And you know, I'm a product of, you know, a public school education, and there were things that I had never heard about, like, for example, the Tulsa massacre. I didn't even know that happened. And so taking the time to really understand the issues that have been part of our country for hundreds of years has been a call to action. And, you know, you can't change things overnight. It has to happen at many levels. And you have to first of all, have an open heart and an open mind and educate yourself. But it's through legislation. It's through, you know, community effort about voting, and not just November 3rd. There are elections that go on, you know, every year that you have to pay attention to. So it's about connecting with the community and doing what the NBA has stood for and been at the forefront of, and that is allowing our players a platform, empowering them to speak out on things that they care about or not. You know, just, you know, it doesn't mean the players have to participate, but the players that do, we don't muzzle them. We want them to, you know, we want to support our players.
Last thought on this. You mentioned, you know, that we have to have these conversations with our white friends who maybe haven't quite figured out why these issues are so critical and why Black NBA players, Black Americans, period, are fighting so strongly for, whether it's police reform, you know, ending the voter disenfranchisement, all these things. It's not as vital to people who look like you and me or immediate, because it doesn't affect us in that same, you know, immediate way, right? I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that, you know, it was, I think, a week ago at USA Today and The Ringer both had done an analysis of where NBA owners have contributed their money politically. And so, you know, even within the ranks of your fellow board of governors, there's some discussions that I'm curious, to the extent that you said, you don't have to name names, but to the extent that you said you've had to just have these conversations with white friends to say, hey, listen, this is why I feel this way. This is why I think you need to kind of open your mind a little bit and think about these things. Do those discussions happen at the Board of Governors? Because I have to believe, as much as the NBA as a whole and as an institution has been very supportive on these issues, I have to think that it's not that uniform or uniformly enthusiastic among the governors, because there are some various political points of view there, and we've seen that in their donations.
Yeah, I mean, everybody gets to vote the way they want to vote. That's not what we're trying to do. But what I can tell you was the formation and the dedication of resources over the justice initiatives, that was a unanimous vote. And all teams agreed to fund this $300 million fund that we're creating to create opportunities. And so we're, you know, I would say that we are on the same page that way. But, in terms of political debates, I'm not going to get into it. I want people to educate themselves and then come to their own conclusions.
Yeah. And I apologize to the listeners. Our producer, Stacey, will, I'm sure, clean up some of that. We had some internet glitching there, but you were referring to the $300 million that the league, the 30 owners together are committing to social justice. And I think the partnership with More Than a Vote and making as many arenas as possible available for voting on Election Day, all of that. So anyway, Jeannie, this has been fantastic. I kept you long. I appreciate all the time and the thoughts and bearing with me on some of the internet glitchiness, but good luck down there in Bubbleville, adjacent Bubbleville, the bubble suburbs, I guess you're in.
Thank you. Bubbleville. Thank you, Howard. Good to talk to you.
You too. Thanks.